AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Have you seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner. I've caddied for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
And you're very welcome to Golf Weekly. As the golf season winds down to its inevitable pause, we can't really say stop because golf doesn't ever stop, with Gary away swinging it up in Cambodia for the second week in a row. Just to let you know, he finished middle of the pack last week, so creditable enough. It was not bad. So it's just me, but I'm not really on my own because I'm joined in this very, very special edition of Golf Weekly by someone who has chronicled Irish golf with a depth, curiosity and longevity unmatched by anyone else. He filed his first report as a 19-year-old in 1960, covering a Monday morning playoff won by Christy O'Connor Sr. And it was a fitting opening chapter for someone who would go on to spend more than six decades charting the fortunes of Ireland's greatest players across 65 years, and stints at the Evening Press, the Irish Independent, the Irish Times and the Sunday Independent, Dermot Galise has witnessed golf's evolution firsthand. His latest book, Chasing Ladybirds, How Irish Players Scaled Golf's Summit, is a look back at the history of golf from, say, the early decades of the 20th century, culminating in this wonderful sweep of the Open Championship by no less than four Irish golfers. Dermot joins me in studio. Very, very pleased to have you in. Dermot, I must say, it's a natural subject because maybe golf fans of a certain generation just assume that we've been immensely successful. And with the sole exception of Fred Daly, we really lived in barren times when it came to summiting the major mountain.
Yes, Fionn, and thank you so much for your introduction. You've been very complimentary. I became fascinated with early Irish golf. I suppose when I was with the Irish Times particularly, I had a column there, Golfing Log, and it allowed me to delve a bit, you know, and to indulge myself. And I look back and was fascinated to a degree, you know, by what players were able to achieve in pretty dire circumstances. But I just learned to love the whole thing, really, Fionn. You know, I became fascinated by it and it became very much my life.
I mean, it seems that in order to write well about golf or to write accurately about golf, I don't know, am I being naive, but that you need to love the game, because it can't, golf is one of those weird things that you just, you have to love it even when it's terrible or even when it's cold and wet and the players you like aren't doing anything. Like, do you think, I mean, am I just being like very simplistic and naive?
I found it pretty easy. Not because I had any particular talent. I mean, I'm one of these people who believes that you can do anything if you apply yourself to it. Golf was very welcoming. I remember when I became a golf correspondent with the Independent, first of all, and then with the Irish Times, that the actual clubs themselves were very welcoming. I mean, I imagine they were looking for publicity and stuff like that, but it was an easy game to get into in that the players were very accessible. Unlike sport nowadays, everything was quite accessible, and you became a fairly important person to the players. You know, I mean, they recognised that you were put there to publicise the game. In from their perspective, you were there simply to do a job, I suppose, from my own perspective. But it was fairly easy, I thought.
We'll talk about that access and the changing media landscape. That means that traditional golf writers just don't have the same relationships with the players that you would have done, certainly in years past. But we'll start with the broad view here. Is the book itself, Chasing Ladybirds, How Irish Players Scaled Golf Summit. And weirdly enough, most of the book doesn't deal with Rory, Porrick, Darren Clarke or Shane Lowry. It deals with players that belong to the lore of Irish golf. Why?
Well, you have to start somewhere. And the first serious Irish golfer from an international perspective was Michael Morne.
Yeah.
And that was in 1913 that he was third in the Open Championship. And his, like, is an extraordinary story. I mean, to be born in the middle of what became Roy Dublin Golf Course.
Sorry, because was he born in a cottage on the third or fourth hole?
Yeah, between the third and the 13th.
Oh, sorry, right.
It's now a greenkeeper's facility. But, it was a tin roof, one or two rooms, I imagine. And he was born there, and when the club was formed there, in 1885, but it didn't move to Roy Dublin the Bull Island until sometime later, about the 90s, I think. And it was natural for him to become involved. He became involved initially as a caddy, and showed some talent at the game, and graduated through then. That process to become the actual pro, and went as a young man to the Open at Hoylake, Royal Liverpool, and remarkably finished third. He could have won it, and I don't say that lightly, because history tells us that he had a potentially disastrous 10 on the first hole of the third round, and recovered from that. He shot an 89 in that round, which wasn't all that high in those days. You know, 80 was fairly common. But anyway, he revived to 74, I think, in the last round, and finished third. He got £12.10 for his trouble. And as such, became the first Irish player to win money, to win prize money at the Open.
Sorry, the first ever?
Ever, yeah, to win prize money.
Now, it's interesting because Michael Morne is a name that would be unknown to most but the golfing aficionados or anyone who knows about the Morne Cup.
Yeah.
Which is named after him. And he suffered an untimely end.
Yes, he was killed in 1918. He joined the British Army. He had joined the equivalent of what would have been then the FCA. We called it the FCA. It was a local force. So he had soldiering in his blood, shall we say. But he got a job as a consequence of his performance at Hoylake. He was offered a job as a pro at Seaham Harbour, which is in the northeast of England near Sunderland. And it was a relatively new club at the time. Actually, Alistair McKenzie designed the golf course. And he went over there, and I suppose the atmosphere there in Britain, the First World War, as you know, happened in 1914, and I think he was swept along by
patriotic fervor.
Yeah, I don't know if it was patriotic. I think he just liked soldiering, you know.
All right, fair enough.
And he was fascinated by the possibility of going to the continent to fight for king and country. I don't know whether he was that way inclined British-wise or whether, as I say, it was an adventure for him. I suspect it was an adventure. Mm. Anyway, then he became a lance corporal and he was with the Irish Horse Regiment. And there was an infamous onslaught by the Germans, the last big one I think they had, in the spring of 1918. And it's difficult to know because reports were pretty thin at the time. And I don't think that we can accurately say when he actually died in battle, but it would have been as one of the physically leading troops in that particular battle. And he was killed. He was taken to a German hospital and didn't recover from wounds and died. It was December. I think they reckon it happened in April of 2018, and it was December of that year.
So he would have been held in hospital for months and then just died of his wounds. Jeez.
Yeah, but it was the notification of his death didn't come back to Dublin for about 6-7 months, you know.
Right.
And that was the way things were back then.
So he, like, his memory has been immortalised in the Moran Cup. I noticed that Gary McGrain just is the most recent winner of the Moran Cup. Another player whose name is connected to the amateur ranks is Jimmy Broome.
Yeah.
And you write kind of evocatively about him as well.
Yeah, I think, again, I don't know if I met Broome. I don't think I did. But I know I was fascinated by him. Joe Carr's biography. And he was sort of a contemporary of Broome's to a degree. The latter part of Broome's career would have coincided with the emergence of Carr. But Carr told me a lot about Broome, and he was unquestionably a fascinating character. And he had this famous Broome loop, which was it was an unusual method of hitting the ball, other than the fact that he created enormous clubhead speed and hit the ball prodigious distances for the time, given the equipment he had. And all of this happened like when he was quite young. I mean, he was just turned 18 when he played in the Walker Cup at St Andrews in 1938. And then he came back in 39 for the Open Championship at St Andrews. And probably his greatest achievement was, at that time, you played two qualifying rounds and then you had four rounds of the tournament proper. And over six rounds, if you were to combine all six rounds together, he would have been second overall. I mean, this is against the best professionals of the day. In fact, he had to settle for being leading amateur. I think he was 13th. But I was fascinated by this. I mean, all the great golf writers of the time, Henry Longhurst notably, was totally swept away by Broome, and as was Henry Cotton, the great British professional. And they just admired his skills, as did Carr. Carr was a rival, very much so, but he admired him greatly as well. I mean, Broome did extraordinary things in terms of driving the green at par fours on a regular basis. And he won the British Amateur in 1946 at Royal Birkdale. And I was taken, very much taken, as I say, by the Jack the Lad type of attitude that seemed to permeate his performances.
What do you mean by that?
'30s. He was only a kid, and he was taken on serious professionals and enjoying every minute of it.
Like, he wasn't he wasn't bowed by the
oh no,
the gravity
he,
of it
he
all.
He used to go out when he'd finish a round, even if it was a 66 or a 67. He was so enthused by the whole thing. He'd go back out on the golf course and look at other players, you know, and remark on, I saw so-and-so playing a shot. He'd talk afterwards about it. You know, his mother, meanwhile, went with him in 39 to St Andrews, and she stayed in Russick's Hotel, which is the hotel overlooking the 18th fairway. And she was obviously swept up in that. She was my son, Jimmy, attitude, I imagine. But it was a lovely story, really, you know, that one so young could have done what he did.
After a fair amount of near misses, the Irish players, finally at their hand on the claret jug in 1947, good old Fred Daly.
Yeah.
And it's a funny one, is that, like, even in my mind, the name of Fred Daly is singularly associated with the Open and nothing else. But, like, obviously he was quite the player.
Oh, he was a very good player. Yeah. I mean, in 47, he did a double, which was the match play championship, which was sponsored by the News of the World at the time. And I don't think that hadn't been done for 40 years or something like that, you know. And he was a leading Irishman in the Open for about 4 or 5 years in a row, you know. It wasn't a surprise. I mean, I remember Harry Bradshaw, who was a very close friend of his and a really good friend. Bradshaw told me that he made as much money out of Fred winning the Open in 47 as Fred did, because they backed him heavily. And he was very highly regarded by his contemporaries here. And I don't know how the British generally would have viewed him, but he was a very fine player, no question.
Now, in the book, I mean, you contend, maybe not forcefully, but you definitely contend that had Harry Bradshaw, who came a cropper in 1949, so 2 years later, the bottle incident.
Yeah.
So maybe for those who aren't familiar, do you want to remind us of what the bottle incident was?
Well, it happened in the second round of the Open, and it was at the fifth hole at Royal St George's. And Harry had qualified very strongly and was obviously in very good form. And anyway, he pushed his tee shot into rough on the right and was horrified on arrival at the ball to discover that it was lodged in glass. And now, there's been a lot of fairy tales written and spoken about.
Yeah.
I suspect not least by Harry himself,
right,
you know, who was a great man at the bar in Portmarnock to regale anybody prepared to listen. And he had a wonderful audience for his stories. But Harry claimed that the ball was lodged in the base of a broken bottle. The neck of the bottle was turned upside down and stuck in the sand, and the ball was in the middle of that end.
The greatest trick shot ever, maybe.
And, I tended to believe, listening to Harry and sort of reading between the lines, that the ball happened to land amid broken glass.
Yeah.
Presumably from a bottle that was left there. The real myth was created by the fact that when Harry came in after his round, having taken a six at the hole, a par four, when he came in afterwards, he was met by journalists and photographers who asked him, and he probably volunteered because it was very, I don't think there was anybody with him other than his playing partners and caddies. Anyway, he told them all about this ball in the bottle tragedy that he had experienced. And a photographer from the Liverpool Evening Post thought this was potentially a great story. And he brought Harry to the back of the professional shop in Royal St George's And they reenacted the scene from the fifth out on the golf course. In other words, to gild the lily somewhat, they got a Guinness bottle and broke it and stuck it in sand and put the ball into it. And Hardy stood peering down, looking into this horrific scene, quote unquote. And the photograph was taken and it was appeared in the paper, and I saw it for the first time in the history of Royal St. George's, and it has since appeared in the history of Royal Portrush. Harry looking down into a broken bottle. Now, frankly, I don't think that happened, as I say. I believe, Fionn, that the ball finished up in glass. What happened then was that at the time, the general rule of golf at the time was that if a ball could be moved into a playable position with a golf club, that it was playable. So Harry took a 9-iron and turned his head away, closed his eyes and had a smash at it. I moved it about 10 yards. The upshot of it was that he took a 6 at the hole. Now, it gained considerable, notoriety, the incident, because of the fact that he was actually tied ultimately with Bobby Locke for the title.
That's right.
And then lost the playoff. In other words, people referred back to the second round. Had Harry taken a bogey even at that hole, he'd have won. But I don't think it's as simple as that, you know.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you contend that were it not for that incident, that Bradshaw would have won the Open.
I don't think I'd said that.
Okay, so you don't think. Because no, Bobby Locke took a 7. Now, I realise you went OB and then reloaded and all the rest. But at the time, they had a 36-hole playoff because they finished level or on level scores. And Locke destroyed him by 12 shots.
Yeah.
So, and I think that certainly because over the years, and I've heard the bottle story, and interestingly, I hadn't heard that they had recreated the shot. Yeah. To my mind, I always thought it was like, I went into half a broken Guinness bottle.
Yeah.
And it was in England, and I was like, what a coincidence, the Irish player. Anyway, look, never let the truth get in the way of a good tale.
But that was it.
But my point being is that, like, the way I've always heard the story, and I've heard it from my aunts who were very serious golfers, was that Harry Bradshaw, he was the unluckiest of unlucky golfers. If it wasn't for that, sure, look, we would have had two Open winners in 3 years.
Well, I think the unlucky part of it was created by the public in their ignorance. For instance, there was an assumption that if Bradshaw had sought a ruling, that he would have been permitted to drop the ball, a free drop effect. So he would have saved himself a couple of shots, but certainly one shot. But that wasn't the case. I mean, the rules at the time didn't permit him to do that.
You also, and I thought this was a nice little, you also wrote that, like, unlike today where, you know, referees are like literally you click your fingers and one shows up. It's just that, like, he's on the fifth hole. Like, he could have been waiting 40 minutes before a ref would show up.
There was nobody there.
There was no one there.
No.
And so it's interesting is that he opted to go, look, let's just keep going. Because, as we know, a golfer who spends forever waiting is only getting himself into all kinds of trouble. So,
yeah, he reckoned he spent about 10 minutes with his partner, talking about their options, his options. And the general rule of thumb in match play at that time, it didn't apply in stroke play because the rules were later changed, but the general rule of thumb was you play the balls as it lies. And Harry applied that. And I think he was right. The RNA, and I was very lucky to talk to John Glover, who was the rules secretary at the time, and he gave me the full facts, and the full facts tell me that Harry did the right thing and that he was simply unlucky in where the ball happened to land.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubric Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubric.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
I mean, in the review notes for the book, like, it notes that Irish golfing success has never been plain sailing. What do you think were the patterns that eventually allowed Irish players? Like, what was the difference between talented players, whether it was Michael Moran or Jimmy Bruin or Fred Daly or Harry Bradshaw? We'll talk about Christy now in a second. Maybe the greatest Irish player never to win, like, to reach the summits. But what are the differences, do you think, that all of a sudden allowed not just one, but four players from the island? And by the way, I don't know if you can hear, there's like this mad drilling noise. This to the audience is like, just to give you a peek behind the curtain. So we're in the studio that we're always in for Golf Weekly, but the entire building is being redone. So outside of what is meant to be a soundproof room is just like, I can hear this infernal drilling. So forgive us if it's interfering. Anyway, but like, what do you think are the, like, what are the shift? What is the pattern shift that allowed? Is it just a case of like our luck came in? Or do you think that there was some fundamental kind of pivot in the way Irish golf produced players, treated players, allowed players to flourish?
I think the key to success in sport, in any sport, is self-belief. And we didn't have that until Padraig Harrington came along.
Which, that's an extraordinary, I've no doubt, a true thing to say, but it's nevertheless an extraordinary thing.
Well, I'll give you, for instance,
yeah,
a leading Irish player, and I won't name him because I wouldn't want to embarrass him, but I remember talking to this guy prior to the Open one particular year, and I asked him, you know, looking forward to the Open, oh yeah, great, great championship, I love it. Hope to do well? Oh yeah, top 10? Oh, that'd be good, yeah, there's loads of prize money there. Top 5? That'd be really doing well. And then I put it to him, I said, what about winning it? And he said, ah, now, come on, he said, they're all really? Here, you know.
Really? They're, so he'd already here. Beaten himself before he hit
they're
the first
all
shot.
Here. David Fairdy was the only one who very openly said that he didn't have what it took.
That, sorry, he said about himself.
He said about yeah. himself. He didn't have he didn't have the necessary stuff. Now, it's amazing. Bob Rotella, who wrote
The foreword.
The foreword, yeah. And he's most enlightening. I mean, but Bob Rotella had the view that he called it contagion, that players learn from each other. Now, I thought it was fascinating. I remember Harrington telling me that when Michael Campbell won the US Open in 2005, at Pinehurst, Harrington said, I was really taken by that. And I said, why? Well, he said, I knocked the ball around in practice with Michael regularly over the last 4 or 5 years. And when he won in Pinehurst, I did think to myself, I'm as good as he is. Why couldn't I do that? And lo and behold, Harrington won the Open 2 years later. Rotella maintains that players learn from each other. And it's you know yourself from golf, Fionn, that you see them together in golf courses, on the practice area, in the practice area, hitting golf balls, talking to each other, looking at what each other is doing. Seeing if there's a different club that they haven't yet tried.
Yeah.
They're always on the lookout for something interesting.
I'm just going to read from your book. This is a Tom Watson quote, which I think it's talking about pressure. So it's not about wobbly knees and trembling hands. It's about making the correct decisions when you're getting wrong messages from a mind that's in turmoil. Only a player with an exceptionally strong mind will recognize those messages for what they are, unless he has been in that position before. That seems to me, now, in a book that's full of fascinating insights, one of the truest things I've ever read about golf. So Watson, multiple major winner, one of the greatest players of all time, he's not saying he doesn't get wobbly knees or trembling hands. He doesn't say he doesn't have a mind in turmoil. He just knows how to allow that to exist while still letting the correct message filter through. Were we not sophisticated is the wrong word, but like, did players of a previous generation, pre-Harrington, maybe didn't have access to that wisdom?
They didn't really, in that, I mean, Watson, for instance, I mean, he's playing with the top players in the world week in, week out on the PGA Tour. And then he plays in the majors, and he's basically playing against the same players, largely the same. Might be a few Europeans thrown in, but essentially the opposition is the same. So he knows, and Harrington said to me that I knew that I could play as well as the guys I was going out against. It was simply a matter of doing it when it really mattered. Now, that Watson quote, I was in Troon. That's from his win at Troon in the Open in 1982. And Des Smith finished fourth on that occasion. And Des told me, he said, I know why I didn't win. Des was actually tied for the lead at one point on the back nine. And he said, I didn't win because I didn't know how to win. And I said, what do you mean, Des? Well, he said, in the final 18 of a major championship, they do fairly tricky things with the pins. They stick them in places where they know it's going to be very difficult to attack or to get up and down from. And he said, I didn't understand this. And I went and I attacked the back nine. And instead of what I should have done was played for pars, instead I went for birdies. And he finished fourth. Watson, coming up the last, was four under, which he didn't think was going to be good enough. He reckoned that a par might get him into a playoff. A birdie would win it. But he said the pin was tucked inside the right-hand bunker. And he said, I knew if I went for the pin and didn't hit the shot correctly, I was going to finish in the bunker and my chances were could go. So he said, I aimed for the middle of the green in the realisation that if I was going to birdie the hole, it would have to be with a 25-foot putt. And that's the way he played it.
But I mean, surely the great players of the past, the ones that never managed to win a major, even surely they must have known, they must have been, have the nous to play percentage golf. Surely, even at the level, whatever it is, whether you're playing like a local championship, like if you took a flag away and make it hard to get to or make it a low percentage shot, surely they must have known. This is like, look, you know, play the middle of the green, give yourself a chance. Always give yourself a chance.
Your brain doesn't always give you the right messages.
Certainly not to me. No. One of the names, and it's funny, you were talking about that sense of confidence that, and we mentioned, obviously, the Open winners, the Irish Open winners. One name we haven't included in it is Graham McDowell, because he didn't win an Open, but he won a US Open.
I
would have known a bunch of players who came up at the same time as Graham did in Irish golf. And whether it was Kieran McMonagall or Ramey Burns or guys like who would have known him quite well. And the unifying comment that they would all make about him, you never met anyone with such bulletproof self-belief as Graham McDowell.
Yeah.
Like to the point of, I mean, and in Ireland where we like to trim our tall poppies, we don't like anyone appearing to be above their station, that it was almost as like, oh, that little arrogant so-and-so. But that arrogance was just like ironclad self-confidence in the hardest game in the world. That is like, look, if I don't believe in myself, well, nobody's going to believe in me. So, and that accounts for a player who doesn't hit the ball a million miles, but has like the nous to really get the ball around the golf course.
Yeah, I think an example of Graham as a wonderful thinker on the game, And this is what we were talking about. You were talking about Watson and the messages you're getting from the brain. I mean, his play of the 72nd hole at Pebble Beach in 2010, when he won the US Open, was an example, a perfect example of Graham as a great thinker. I mean, he hit a very good drive. He could have gone for the green in two. Instead, his caddy told him to lay up with him. I think it was an 8 or a 9 iron he hit short of the bunkers, short of the actual rise. He hit his third shot to about 20 feet past the pin. So he needs two putts to win. And it was exemplary in terms of management of his game, how he played that particular hole. And that's what you got to look at. You know, you can get lucky on a final hole in that. But again, Harrington, for instance, at the PGA Championship, which he won in 2008, his management of the hole, I mean, he drives into rough and he knows he can't make the green. So he lays up. The second shot is in a bunker. He's still not panicking. And he gets up and down from the bunker. It sinks about a 15-foot putt. But he had himself mentally adjusted to the idea, this is what I'm going to have to do to win.
Is that the last part of Watson's thing? Only a player with an exceptionally strong mind will recognise those messages for what they are, and then the key, unless he has been in that position before.
Yeah.
Harrington has already got two majors in his locker.
Absolutely.
So he's approaching the PGA with an entirely different mental framework.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's definitely a lot more confident. Like when he won at Carnoustie, I mean, we all know what happened at the 18th. But I mean, that six at the 18th was probably the finest finishing six to win, potentially, when he had to go into a playoff, that anybody has ever done.
Well, was it a 46-yard pitch?
I think it was 48, yeah.
And a 5-foot putt.
And a 5-foot putt. Yeah. I mean, when the ball went 5 foot past, I mean, Ronan Flood, his caddy, was screaming, stop, stop, stop. He was hoping for a tap-in. And suddenly he sees the ball going 5 feet past the hole, and Harrington can't see how far it is because he's looking at it from the wrong side. And Harrington's delighted with what he's done, and Ronan is panicking, saying, Christ, he still has to put from 5 feet to win. And Harrington tapped it in, he said afterwards, as if it was nothing. It was only when he looked at the rerun on television that he realised what he'd done.
Yeah.
But
I mean, Harrington has said it many times. He said it here in studio with us. He says that it's the only time in his golfing career that he ever felt a feeling of embarrassment was when he went into the burn twice.
Well, funny, I write that in the book that,
yeah,
I mean,
did.
Given the same situation myself, I'd have thrown the clubs there and run out the gate.
You're playing in front of, and then interestingly enough, and you dedicate a whole chapter to the role of the caddy.
Yeah.
And so that 150-yard walk up to what would have been the pitch shot that was his fifth shot. You could make a kind of an argument that Ronan won the Open Championship for Porrick.
Well, he certainly contributed hugely.
Yeah. To us a little bit about exactly what Ronan did for Porrick in that key 150 yards.
Well, as you were suggesting, the embarrassment. Harrington didn't like that particular hole. I know that because he had played it badly in the British Amateur. I think it was in 93 or 94, and he was fearful of it. I mean, it's a dangerous hole. I wouldn't say it's a great hole, but I remember asking him, did he consider the Barry Byrne to be a strategic hazard or a random hazard? I think it's random. I think it just happens to wander around. There used to be a par 5, as we know, and was reduced to a par 4. As a par 5, it's a much simpler hole. I mean, you simply you play a three wood off the tee and then you just knock it down towards the burn and then the third one on and Bob's your uncle. But Harrington didn't like the hole. And then when he drove into the burn, I suppose he would have still felt reasonably comfortable in himself because he had been playing really, really well. But he took a five iron and all he could see, I imagine, was the out of bounds left of the green. And he has to aim there and cut it in. It's really the only realistic shot he has. Excuse me. And he puts the second shot into the burn again. Now he wants to run out the gate. There's no question about it. He's usually embarrassed by this. And Ronan started talking to him. And Padraig didn't answer. And Ronan kept at him. Come on, come on, come on. It's not over. It's not over. Wait, see what happens. See what happens. And Harrington still didn't answer. And eventually, you talked about a 150-yard walk. But halfway through that walk, Harrington began to listen to Ronan. And he responded for the first time. And he said, by the time he got up to the ball to pitch it onto the green, he was back in the zone. Ronan talked him into the reality of what they were in, that you don't look to what might happen and how the scoreboard's going to look. Look at now. This is what you have to do now. And I think that was priceless. I mean, you wonder what a caddy can contribute, and surely the player does everything. But in terms of strong mind, Fionn, I keep looking back or thinking back to Watson and Nicklaus. Watson talking about Nicklaus. And he talked a lot about Nicklaus after Turnberry in 77 when they had the famous duel in the sun. Yeah. And Watson said, I have seen better players than Nicklaus. I have seen better ball strikers than Nicklaus. I've seen players with a better short game than Nicklaus. But he said, I have never, ever seen a player who can get the ball around the golf course, manage his ball around the golf course, like Nicklaus can. Mm. And that was the key. That's why Nicklaus won 18 majors, because of his mental strength.
There's, I can't remember which major it was, but it was on the Sky coverage ahead of the final day of A Major, and Jack Nicklaus and Colin Montgomery were both in studio. And whoever it was, the host, David Livingston maybe, was asking Monty about, like, you know, obviously here we are, final day, the major, might have been the Open Championship.
It was the US Open at Pebble Beach.
Oh, was it the US Open?
At Pebble Beach when Tom Kite won.
But Monty said, he goes, well, obviously, you know, this is different gravy. This is the day four of the major is an entirely different thing. And Nicklaus almost couldn't mask his contempt for the comment. He was just like, no, it's exactly the same thing. Yeah. It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Now, I was going, like, it's easy for Nicklaus to say, maybe, probably to that point that you're making, Nicklaus had access to a steel, a mental steel that few others, maybe Tiger Woods,
you're right,
is the only,
absolutely,
is the only player.
You're absolutely
had access
right
to a mental steel that made day four of a major the same as Thursday in a major.
Yeah, it was almost like a mathematical challenge. You know, what do I have to do here to win this? I'll have to shoot 68.
Yeah.
And he'd go out and he'd shoot 68.
Because, and it brings me to the one, perhaps, and certainly not in the modern age, because obviously with Darren, Shane, Rory and Porrick, names who've done brilliant with the Open, but the name, the Irish golfer that in the kind of could have been, and lots of people would say should have been, is Christy Senior. Like, what did he play? 28 Opens or something like that?
I don't remember, to be honest, Fiona.
I'm sure Christy probably didn't remember at the end either. But like, played so many Opens, finished second once, I think. Like, and even in the book, you have like the list of all the all his finishes. Yeah. Like, no Irish name until Porrick's win was, or Fred, let's give Fred Daly his due, obviously. But no name is associated with the Open Championship, certainly from Ireland, as Christie Senior. And it's ultimately the story of what could have been.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can contribute really is what, excuse me, two contemporaries told me about Christie and the Open. Jimmy Kinsler, who knew Christie very well, was actually his assistant at Bundoran for a short time, claimed that Christie didn't prepare himself properly for the Open. And I said, what do you mean? And he said he didn't treat it with the respect that a major championship should be treated. In other words, he looked upon it as an ordinary tournament because he was playing largely against the same guys he was meeting week in, week out on tour. And I said, was that enough, Jimmy, to create this inability to see the job through? And Jimmy said, it is because the majors, the Open, Christie, by his own admission, reckoned that the Open was no more than a pension. That's what he described it to me as. If I won the Open, he said, it was no more than a pension. And there really wasn't big money there in it at the time, and contracts were pretty skinny. I mean, Fred Daly got £150 in prize money. He might have had a few contracts, but Fred, like, drove a Vauxhall Viva and had a pretty modest lifestyle for somebody who was a major winner. So there's no real money in it. Mm. But the honour and glory, Harry Bradshaw was of the view that Christie didn't want to win the Open deep down. And I asked him, why would he think that way? And the Brad reckoned because he said, Christie would have become an international player. He would have put demands on him to go to the States far more than he wanted to. And Christie was a home bird who wanted to play in these islands, comfortable in the sort of opposition he would have around here. And he didn't want to spread his wings and become an international player.
It's also worth pointing out is that at that time, very few Irish, very few Irish players would have travelled to America to play, because the other three majors, certainly in the modern age, are all in America. So would did Christie ever play anything other than the Open?
He tried to qualify for the US Open once and failed.
Yeah.
He had a standing invitation to Augusta from 1955 to 73 as a current Ryder Cup player. Now, this is what bothers me. I mean, he did actually tell me that he was sorry not to have played the Masters.
Yeah.
But at a time when nearly all his British contemporaries, Peter Alice, Bernard Hunt, Harry Wheatman, they all, Neil Coles even, who hated flying, they all played the Masters at least once, and Christie didn't. I think that tells you a lot. Mm. It confirms to me the Bradshaw theory that he didn't want to spread his wings. He didn't want to become a truly international player.
I mean, it's also as well as this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we're looking back at the way the majors were perceived then, but with the lens of today, where the majors have this outsized importance. They're like the thing. I mean, I know that, yes, they would have been, they had a certain amount of prestige, but they didn't occupy the same exalted status that they do now. So I'm sure Christie would have been out of pocket having to schlep all the way to Augusta.
No, that's exactly it. That was his reasoning. He said, I could never get a situation in which I could set up two or three tournaments on either side of the Masters to justify the expense of going there.
Yeah. I mean, look, the book is full of remarkable anecdotes. I mean, what have you done? 40 Opens since 1980? You covered 40.
40, yeah.
What was your favourite one?
I think I keep going back. I mean, Shane Lowry was wonderful in 2019, but the one that had the magic, really, because of where it was Seve in 84 at St Andrews. I mean, you had the venue, let's be honest. I mean, there's no place like St Andrews. You had the winner, Seve. I mean, everybody loved Seve. And the weather was glorious. Sunshine from start to finish. Dust kicking up every time a ball hit one of the fairways. And I just loved every minute of that. Maybe it was the mood I was in, I don't know. Funny, Michael Bonalik, and that was his first Open as Secretary of the RNA, had that as his favourite as well.
It's also, again, in the 80s, it was a time when, as an established golf writer, that you would have access to the players. You would have, Tom Collin that tells the story of being at the Butler cabin in the 1970s. You just sit there and the players would come by and sit and chat, and that level of access that today just is just like unthinkable.
Yeah. I'm reminded of reading about Bernard Darwin, who was the king of golf writers. 1951 Open, and the winner
1951 in Portrush it was this is going to kill me now.
No, I know it, but we're going to have to go over it.
Oh my god. Was it won by Max Faulkner?
Max Faulkner, yeah.
I had to Google that.
1981, the Open at Royal Portrush, and Darwin was sitting down near the 18th when Max Faulkner emerged as the winner, which he was always going to because he was leading. Most of the way home. And Darwin turned to him and said, Faulkner, he said, sit down here, he said, and I'll write about you.
But, I mean, and again, and this, you know, this is not covered really in the book, but it's the different perception of the professional. The golf professional was little better than, you know, than an ironmonger, like compared to, you know, it was still kind of the tail end of, you know, the glorious amateur, and that somehow being a golf professional was somehow not quite as noteworthy as it is now.
Yeah, well, I mean, Peter Thompson was probably the first touring professional. Well, Bobby Locke at around the same time. They were probably the first touring professionals as we know them today. But for the rest of them, I mean, they were club pros.
Club pros who,
and they finished the Open on a Friday, with the third and fourth rounds played morning and afternoon, so that the pro would be back at his golf club at the weekend to look after his members. I mean, that's the way things were. You're right, Henry Cotton was changed the image a bit. Like, I mean, driving a Rolls Royce, and any time there was a problem in access to a golf club, he had his batman lay out a meal for him, you know, in front of the roller in the car park of the club, you know, to embarrass them. Peter Alice tells an interesting story, and Alice had an extraordinary command of the English language for somebody who was largely uneducated. I mean, he told me that as a 14-year-old, he went to a private school up to the age of 14. And then he went to work with his father in his father's pro shop. And he said he learned how to write and how to speak from sitting in the pro shop, listening to the golf club members come in and talk to his father. And he said most of them were professional people and they spoke the language as it should be spoken. And he listened and he learned. But in 1953, Alice played the Ryder Cup for the first time. And prior to that, he was the pro, and the committee had a meeting, and they've said to him, if you become a Ryder Cup professional member of the team, we will allow you to come in the main door into the clubhouse. And it was a serious committee decision. And he duly became a Ryder Cup player, and they didn't let him in the front door. And he had to remind them of what they had passed at committee level. And they said, we're very sorry, Peter. Of course, come in.
Dermot, time is against us, but I have a couple of questions. One, so there's excited talk about Portmarnock hosting an Open Championship at some point in the 2030s. And I had never heard of this before, but you draw an interesting parallel about the debate on whether Portmarnock in the Republic of Ireland should host the Open Championship, which should be played in the United Kingdom, according to some, but also with a similar debate over, was it the hosting of the British Amateur in 1949? So was it the year that Johnny Costello declared an Irish Republic? And there was a debate. So, you know, the old, you know, everything's changed and everything remains the same. What was the, like, what was the main thrust of the argument in 1949?
Well, I mean, the thrust of the argument was very simple. I mean, we were part of the British Commonwealth before Costello.
Who was a member of Portmarnock, by the way. That's,
yeah.
Wasn't he?
Yeah. He decided in, actually, he went on a trip to Canada in October 48, and he made the decision then, and it was an impromptu decision. But anyway, it was ratified in law the following April. Now, prior to that, I mean, the king, the British king, was our head of state. And we were part of the British Commonwealth. We were a free state within the Commonwealth. But there was outrage when, I think it was Henry Longhurst said, we might as well play the thing at Le Touquet. He said, you're going to have to be bringing your passport to go to one of our major championships. But anyway, they filled Henry full of whiskey in Portmarnock when he actually did come to the event. They couldn't have changed it, Fionn, because, I mean, it takes about 3 or 4 years to arrange these things. And, I mean, when Costello sprang this on them in April of 49, I mean, they 3 months. So there was no question of it being changed. But they effectively bit the bullet at the time. But I think the crucial difference now, and it was the British Amateur, the same way as the Open was the British Open.
Interestingly, and I
didn't
know. It
is no longer the British Open.
Yes, it's the Open.
It's the Open. So it's no longer a political decision. It is a commercial decision.
But what's interesting, just as a side note, to my mind, that the use of the Open suggests legacy and history and heritage, when the opposite is actually true, that it, like, traditionally it was called the British Open. Yeah.
Yeah, they were entitled to. I mean, they were the first.
Yeah, no.
1860.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't have a problem with anything they did. I thought that how they handled 49 and the amateur was fascinating. I mean, as I say, I think Longhurst took it upon himself to be a spokesman for the British establishment by telling us, like, that this is outrageous. But in the early 90s, when Carnoustie and Hoylake were no longer on the rota, the Open rota, I know from Michael Bonalik that he was very anxious at that time to come to Portmarnock.
Right.
Yeah. They saw it's a commercial thing. I mean, they're going to make a fortune.
I was going to say, like,
they're going to make a fortune having it. I mean, they've done remarkably well in Portrush. The reason it went to Portrush in 2019 was because of the success of the Irish Open in Portrush in 2012.
That's right.
Where they had record attendances. They got terrific. They've declared something like 280 million. Sterling from the recent Open. I mean, imagine how they'll do.
They'll clean
Dublin up,
and they're near an international airport.
Yes, I mean everything. Yeah. And Port Marnock has the key ingredient, which is space.
Yeah, that's right.
They had to create space in Portrush by getting rid of the 17th and 18th holes. But Port Marnock, there's 350 acres there.
Dermot, so your second to last book, A Farewell to the Fairways, you followed it by this one, Chasing Ladybirds. Is this your valedictory tour?
My wife hopes it is. The truth, Fionn, and I haven't actually said this to anyone, but the truth is I sort of got used to writing.
Yeah.
I really did.
We've been doing it for a while.
I've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
And I enjoy the process.
Yeah.
I really do. I wouldn't dare say that I'm not going to do another
one. Okay.
But I'm lucky in that my brain has remained reasonably together. The subject matter is unbelievable in golf, as you know. Wonderful characters, great venues.
Great storylines. Yeah, for sure.
And why not?
Absolutely. And the book again, Chasing Ladybirds, How Irish Players Scaled Golf Summit, the author Dermot Galise, with a foreword by Bob Rotella. Dermot, listen, thank you so much for coming to studio.
Thank you, Fionn, for your understanding, first of all. I really enjoyed the chat.
And that's it for Golf Weekly this week. Stay tuned on Friday. We've got the Ryan Line with Shane Ryan coming to you. Talk to you then. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle. Starter kit right here. Now Mama Lou makes chocolate.